Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, listeners. I want to thank our good friends at Slipped Disc for their enthusiastic support of Speaking Soundly. Be sure to check out slippeddisc.com for the latest inside information on classical music now. Today's episode marks the release of our brand new season as we kick off our celebration of Women's History Month with the amazing Barbara Hannigan. Grammy Award-winning soprano and renowned conductor Barbara Hannigan is celebrated for her exceptional voice, dynamic stage presence, and inspired conducting skills. Any one of these talents is enough to distinguish her as an artist at the forefront of creation, but when she decided to sing, act, and conduct simultaneously, she found herself forging new ground.
It hadn't been done before, and because it was so outside the box, I felt really free and I could develop a confidence in my gestures that were unorthodox. Because somehow it feels right to me that we create this together and we eliminated the middleman.
You're listening to Speaking Soundly, a backstage pass to today's biggest stars of the music world. I'm your host, David Krause, principal trumpet of the Metropolitan Opera. During each episode, you'll hear me speak with inspiring performers about their creative process and the personal journey that led them to the stage. You're one of my favorite artists, and I'm so excited to talk to you about your singing and conducting, but I want to start with your singing while you're conducting. You take on both of those roles, and it's amazing to watch because while you're singing so passionately and you're just 100% committed to what you're doing, you're also conducting. I mean, you're setting tempos and giving cues to the entire orchestra. It's amazing to watch. How do you manage to do both so well simultaneously?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you. I'm really happy that you like what I'm doing. And yeah, I mean, I'm a singer and I'm a conductor, and sometimes I'm doing both. And the both part is actually how I started as a conductor, because I think I made my debut when I was 19 as a singer, and then it wasn't until I was 39 or 40 that I started conducting. I didn't imagine when I started my career as a musician, I never even imagined conducting anything. And over the course of my career as a professional singer, I did do a lot of chamber music that would have maybe been easier to do with a conductor, but I preferred not to do it with a conductor. I preferred to find a way to make the chamber music with my colleagues without having someone on the podium. And so I had been developing kind of ways of just signals, really, you know, just signals or leading with shoulder or with showing with the breath and showing how you're going to land something and where's the new tempo and who are you trying to connect with, just locking in, saying, okay, we know where we're at, recognizing in the eyes and the face of the other person, in the gesture of the other person, that we're on the same page and we're in the same flow. But it was around 2007 that colleagues like kind of on a regular basis, started to say to me, oh, have you ever tried conducting? It seems like, you know, that would be very natural to you, or, oh, do you conduct? And there was one producer in France who just simply said, you have to do this. So he's the one that set it all up and made it happen at this big festival at the Châtelet in Paris, which is like a big, huge concert hall right on the Seine, you know? It's like, it's crazy. It's not the kind of place that you do a little quiet little debut. It was like, ta-da! But once he had planted that idea in my head, then I started to kind of go to town with it. Like, how could this happen? And what would I do? And how would I make this? What kind of gestures would I use? And I think in a way, because if it hadn't been done before and because it was so outside the box, I felt really free and I could develop a confidence in my gestures that were unorthodox.
When you made that debut, most conducting debuts would probably happen with repertoire that is not basic, but comfortable.
Yeah, something easy to start with. And I start with Ligeti. Yeah. I start with like one of the most crazy, difficult pieces. Yeah.
Just to sing it or just to conduct it seems incredibly challenging, yet there you are doing both. What did it feel like in the moment when you're actually doing it?
It was exhilarating. I mean, it's a virtuoso piece, and it's like a top sport. It's not a marathon piece, it's a sprinter piece, or it's a gymnastic routine, you know, it's tumbling. And so you can't think about anything else. You just simply have to have visualized and know what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And I conducted it from memory the first time, so I didn't have the score in front of me. I was just kind of on it and in it. And I guess there's a lot of adrenaline going through the system. Somehow it feels right to me that we create this together and we eliminated the middleman.
Part of my job as an orchestral musician is enduring hours and hours of rehearsal as the conductor sings to you, as he or she is trying to get their point across. And by and large, conductors are awful singers, but yeah. It doesn't stop them from singing. Mm. They're like a drunk uncle at the Thanksgiving table. But when you lead rehearsals and you're demonstrating how you want a line to go and you're singing to those in front of you, musicians must swoon at the sound of your beautiful voice.
They usually do react like they're like, you know, and I always forget before I do it that it would make that a particular impression on them because I didn't think about it that way. But I can show, you know, like I can just sing it to them. I can say, no, I want it straight here. I want it straight here. And at this moment, I want the vibrato to come in and at this pace. So I can show how I want it to be. And I, not only for that reason, but I do always warm up before an orchestra rehearsal, whether I'm singing on that rehearsal officially or not. And I do that partly because so that if I demonstrate my voice is working. But secondly, I do it because, well, you'll understand this as a trumpet player, I need to have awoken the breathing instrument, that aspect of my instrument, before I get in front of the orchestra, because it informs how I use my body. It informs how I breathe with the orchestra and how I show phrase and how I show, you know, the space between the phrases, basically.
So I have a son who's a cellist. And at the time when he was at Juilliard, I remember he said, you have to come to this orchestra concert he was playing because the conductor is just amazing. So I went, and it turns out the conductor he was talking about was you. And when I went to the concert, he was absolutely right. I mean, every piece on the program had this, I don't know, vital energy that was palpable even in the audience, especially the Haydn symphony that you conducted, which was composed, what, like 200 years ago. How do you manage to get this kind of energy in everything that you do?
Well, first of all, Haydn is, I mean, he's my favorite. I mean, I'm programming Haydn as often as possible. I'm creating little worlds, like a two-hour world that we want to live in for a week of rehearsal, you know? So when we love it, the audience is going to be like, wow, they love this so much. Why? What is it? And then they start to feel the passion that we have.
Well, it must have been amazing to do that with a talented group of students because the entire orchestra was on board with you and was just eager to make your vision happen. Can it be harder to elicit that kind of excitement among a room of seasoned professionals that are maybe, I don't know, watching the clock a little more than the students would be?
Like, there's a point when you're a young musician, before you even think about turning professional, before you even think about going to Juilliard or whatever, you're playing, right? You're playing. We play music and we're really into it. And we go to music camp and we go early to school to rehearse with the other musicians. And we play until class has started. And at lunchtime, we get together in the music room and make music together. And then after school, we'd do that. And then we'd play, our jazz band or our orchestra would play at the mall, you know? And then there's a point when you go to school and you realize, oh my God, I have to make a living at this. But I like to treat it all like the music room that I had when I was in high school, because we all had that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gone into the career. So I'm basically just looking for that.
Your voice is so powerful and engaging. I mean, you really cast a spell over anybody in the audience that hears it. When was the first time you felt this sense of power, the power to affect someone with your voice?
Well, my first experience singing, you know, was with our mother. I mean, I have my twin brother and I have my older sister. We're all kind of the same age. And so singing was really important in our family. And it was also important in our community, at our school, music teachers and so on, in this little village where I grew up in Nova Scotia. And I had some solos in the school, you know, pageants and Christmas plays. But I didn't think of it as power or anything like that. I did think that people liked it when I sang, you know, and they still like it when I sing. So if I go home and visit my dad, he's going to have the neighbors over and they're going to expect me to sing "Oh, Danny Boy." And that's as important as whatever the concert is. It's the same thing. And the power thing, I think maybe I could say responsibility for me to keep my voice in shape. Like, the reason for me why it's convenient this interview is at 4 p.m. is because I needed to practice before, you know, and I can't practice after because my voice will be too tired from talking and so on. So that responsibility to keep the instrument in shape and to care for the instrument and to make sure that it can function how I need it to function so that it doesn't cause stress and anxiety for me or others. Somehow the voice, it's so, I mean, I love all instruments and I love all kinds of music, but something about the voice, I suppose, because it's such a vulnerable thing, you know, it's just these two little vocal cords that are vibrating against the other, supported by the entire body, mind, and spirit. It's something really to negotiate and to handle on many levels, on existential levels, philosophical levels, technical levels, discipline levels. You know, how do we serve the instrument, and using the instrument as a very, you know, kind of global word.
Right? Sounds like it's more like a religion to you.
Yeah, it's very precious to be a musician. I can't tell you how many times I think to myself, oh, how fortunate to somehow have chosen this path and to have been able to stay on it. It is sacred, you know? Mm.
You grew up in a small town in Nova Scotia, yet your musical education early on was thorough and intense. Did you just assume everybody grew up like this, or were you aware of how unique that early musical education was?
Well, at first, it was just my mom singing and playing the piano. So that was just normal. But then, the first year that I was in school, we had a music teacher who was fine. But the second year I was in school, we got Miss McEwen. And Miss McEwen, her parents both studied at Juilliard. And here she ended up with her very first teaching job in Waverly, Nova Scotia, not even a town, village, at this little school at the end of a dirt road. And she had a very high level of music training. Now, I didn't know that then. I didn't know that the level of music education we were getting from her was so extraordinary. I don't think she knows how extraordinary it was. Because when I remind her, like last summer I saw her and I was telling her about things that I remember from music class, I think she was flabbergasted in how important I thought that was and how special I thought that was. Because, you know, she's just doing her thing. But I realized probably around age 17 or 18 when I moved to Toronto. So Toronto was the big city, 2 hours away by airplane. And when I was age 17, I moved there. And it was at that point that all these other kids who had grown up in the city, so surrounded by, like, you know, the symphony orchestra and the musicians that were at such a high level, but they were looking at me like, oh, she's really good. Oh, she has good ear training. She has high level of musicianship. And I didn't realize that what I had was something that had been well developed.
It sounds like this amazing musical foundation that you grew up with would really give you the tools later on to master that difficult repertoire that would be a cornerstone of your career. Did you have that same kind of linear, steady progression in the development of your voice, or was that different? Were there bumps along the road?
The bump along the way for me was performance anxiety, because that was, and I had that as a pianist, I mean, as a singer, as a everything I had since my teens. I would get so nervous, and I still get nervous. But I handle it better now. But I spend an inordinate amount of energy trying to find a way to handle my nerves. Because as you know, as a brass player, like if something walks in to your performance space and says, I'm going to take away your breath, I'm going to make your heart beat really fast, I'm going to retract the tongue, the diaphragm's going to pull back, and you're going to have sweaty hands and a dry mouth. Now go sing and have fun. Like that's really tough.
I'm literally sweating just as you're describing that, because that's exactly the way it happens.
Of course, that's it. And so how to deal with that? And it was awful. I remember, like, sometimes I would be nervous about a gig like 2 years before. You know, I would be nervous just picking up the score and practicing it alone. I hesitate to say it was a blessing, but it's in my nature to say it was a blessing in disguise, because it forced me to look at philosophy and psychology of mental strength, you know, and discipline. And I ended up going the route of what athletes are doing. So I ended up working with a lot of professional athletes, making all those kind of connections as to how to perform in peak and optimal level under pressure and under nerves. I've been working on mastering performance under pressure. And by mastering, I don't mean perfection. I just mean having a satisfying performance experience.
I want to ask you an odd question about your career. As a soprano, you've never had to prove yourself because all sopranos are women, right? I mean, it's a dumb sentence.
But I've said that too. I've said that, yeah.
Well, when you contrast that with when you began conducting, you quickly entered a field which is primarily dominated by men. Did you ever doubt that you could become a conductor simply because you didn't grow up watching any other female conductors?
Okay, well, first of all, like, my examples as a singer or as a conductor are not other singers or other conductors. They're just people that are authentic to themselves, like, you know, Jackie Chan, Barbara Streisand, people that are authentic within their body and to themselves. They don't need to be a conductor or a singer. So I wasn't comparing myself to other conductors, but of course, like, I don't want to walk out there and have the orchestra fumbling because they're not getting what they need. So one must develop the technical capacity to lead properly. And I think every conductor should have doubt, and they should have doubt for their entire career. And they should be trying to ever better their relationship with the orchestra and with the musicians as far as their role is concerned. I know quite a few conductors that still have coachings or have some expert coming in, watching, looking, saying, oh, you know, if you did this, it would be better. And I think that's wisdom.
That's also humility, which can be rare among great conductors and opera singers, simply because so much of their energy has to be on themselves and the music they're creating, that there's always a danger of becoming, how do I say this nicely, self-important.
Like the diva.
Exactly. And you'd have every right to fall into that category as a conductor or a singer, but you don't, which to me is amazing. In fact, you've set up mentorship programs like Equilibrium Young Artists and Momentum. What's the aim of these programs, and why is fostering the next generation of young musicians so important to you?
Well, I really believe in apprenticeship, and certainly music is a field in which apprenticeship and mentorship has basically always been the way, that it's the passing on of knowledge and learning on the job. You know, it's not like somebody graduates from Juilliard and all of a sudden, I'm a professional, and then that's it. You know, it's like you're carried by others. And for whatever reason, since I was young, I've kind of had a talent for bringing out other people's willingness to teach stuff. So like I could get older musicians to share stuff and help me with things. I didn't mind asking questions. I wasn't shy about it. I didn't mind not knowing the answer. Therefore, I experienced a lot of generosity. So then when I got to a point when I had some power and a bit of money in the bank, I thought, well, how am I going to pay it forward? So then I created Equilibrium to create engagements for some young professionals at the first phase of their career. Also to help mentor them through aspects of the career that are a bit taboo to talk about, with one of the main ones being loneliness, the isolation and the loneliness of a career, and how does one navigate that? And I could totally identify with that, having left Canada when I was 24 years old, and what it takes to be a soloist and be on the road 10 or 11 months here, especially at the beginning when you don't have any money. So it's just everything is on the fly, you know? And then Momentum, I started during the pandemic, basically because the young artists of Equilibrium were telling me, we don't have any work. If there's any gigs during the pandemic, they're only hiring the stars. They're not hiring young people. They're only trying to get stars because they want to bring the audiences back. I thought, yeah, well, they're right. So then I just called up a bunch of stars or whatever, well-known performers who were gigging, still getting gigs. And I said, okay, please share the stage with a younger colleague and let's call it Momentum and become part of this. And it's interesting for the audience because the audience is like, wow, Winterfell wants us to listen to this young person, or Natalie Desay is interested in this trio. Why is she interested in them? It seemed like a no-brainer to me. And it gave a lot of good feeling during a very difficult time. It also kept a lot of younger musicians gigging and gave them some hope. It's funny because like in rock music, they do that all the time, right? They have opening act. We don't do it so much in classical music. So Momentum was more a pandemic-based initiative, but Equilibrium is alive and kicking.
It sounds to me like these initiatives stem directly from your experience as a young musician in Nova Scotia, because I've heard you talk about how your choral teacher would bring Equilibrium to the chorus by putting you as a strong singer.
Yeah, she would put me in between the two of the weaker singers. Not every day, but a lot. And I definitely knew that I had to sing louder because she had me do that. Yeah. Like I came from a very small but strong community, and I was fascinated by those kinds of values. And, you know, it was the teachers and parents and other kids' parents, you know, it's like everyone that you encounter in that small little circle. This is pre-internet, pre-Instagram. We didn't even have public transit. So we had to be quite close-knit. And if the power goes out, you go to somebody else's house that has a generator, or if your TV's not working and it's the one night a year that The Sound of Music is on, then you're going to be getting the neighbors to invite you in. It's like, so, yeah, I think it all does come from the village in Nova Scotia where I grew up.
That sense of community and the importance of music is evident in every performance you give. I mean, when you perform, there's a real connection between you and the audience. So I want to ask, when a performance is over, what do you hope the audience takes with them? Like, is there a message that's somehow bigger than you or bigger than the music itself?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I hope that they arrive at the concert, however they arrived, with whatever happened to them that day, that week, you know, with whatever they're carrying, good or bad. And that somehow by being in the hall with other people and sharing that experience, that they are somehow changed. Whatever it is, it could simply be that the system calmed down, you know, that the system calmed down for half an hour. It could be that they feel a desire to work on something, inspired to work on something, because they saw this group of people with such a collective discipline. That feeling of something changing from the moment that you walk into the hall until you leave. And I certainly have that. I mean, we don't need to expect that everyone sits there and becomes inspired. Sometimes it's just a place of peace. Like, it's just somewhere where you sit down in one place and you concentrate on one thing for 1.5 hours or 2 hours. And wow, I mean, that's also a great gift.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Speaking Soundly. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Be sure to follow, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up on future episodes, follow us on Instagram at SpeakingSNDLY and visit our website, artfulnarrativesmedia.com. Tune in next week as we hear another inspiring artist speaking soundly.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.